This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Ankur Desai, and at 5 o'clock GMT on Wednesday, the 24th of September, these are our main stories. Ukraine's President Zelensky says there has been a big shift in Donald Trump's position on the war with Russia after the US president described Russia as a paper tiger and said Ukraine could take back all the territory it has lost. China evacuates hundreds of thousands as super typhoon Ragasa approaches its southern coast. And also in this podcast, we celebrate the life of actress Claudia Cardinale, who's died aged 87.
They asked me to sign the contract, but I always refused. I want to be independent and free. I don't want to sell my body, and I want to be judged on the acting.
It's no secret President Trump is no fan of the United Nations. And on Tuesday, he told the General Assembly that all he had from the UN was, quote, a bad escalator and a bad teleprompter. In a remarkable speech lasting nearly an hour, Mr. Trump lashed out at more than the UN. Europe, Russia and immigration were all in his crosshairs. After his speech, he met the Ukrainian president and said Ukraine could retake all of its territory from Russia. More on that in just a moment. But first, Peter Goffin has this report on Mr. Trump's speech to the UN General Assembly.
I don't mind making this speech without a teleprompter because the teleprompter is not working.
Standing before the General Assembly, President Donald Trump launched a blistering denunciation of the UN, condemning the institution from the ground up.
All I got from the United Nations was an escalator that on the way up stopped right in the middle. If the First Lady wasn't in great shape, she would have fallen.
The UN later said an escalator safety mechanism was triggered, possibly by the Trump's own cameraman riding ahead of them. Meanwhile, President Trump aired old grievances.
I bid on the renovation and rebuilding of this very United Nations complex. But they decided to go in another direction, which was much more expensive at the time, and which actually produced a far inferior product.
And brought one of his core domestic issues, what he calls the crisis of illegal immigration, to the world stage.
Your countries are being ruined. The United Nations is funding an assault on Western countries and their borders. Think of that. The UN is supporting people that are illegally coming into the United States, and then we have to get them out.
Mr. Trump painted an image of the UN as a toothless, outdated body.
What is the purpose of the United Nations? The UN has such tremendous potential, but it's not even coming close to living up to that potential. For the most part, at least for now, all they seem to do is write a really strongly worded letter and then never follow that letter up. It's empty words. And empty words don't solve war.
He pitched, as an alternative, a new world order centered around his United States.
I've come here today to offer the hand of American leadership and friendship to any nation in this assembly that is willing to join us in forging a safer, more prosperous world.
And his own self-proclaimed prowess as a global broker of peace.
I ended 7 wars, dealt with the leaders of each and every one of these countries have never even received a phone call from the United Nations offering to help in finalizing the deal.
Mr. Trump said he was working relentlessly to stop the killing in Ukraine.
I thought that would be, of the 7 wars that I stopped, I thought that would be the easiest because of my relationship with President Putin, which had always been a good one.
And he had harsh words for some of the leaders sitting before him.
China and India are the primary funders of the ongoing war by continuing to purchase Russian oil. But inexcusably, even NATO countries have not cut off much Russian energy and Russian energy products.
Not even America's closest allies were spared a dressing down.
They can't be doing what they're doing. They're buying oil and gas from Russia while they're fighting Russia. It's embarrassing to them, and it was very embarrassing to them when I found out about it, I can tell you that.
A coup de grace, as President Trump brought a blunt and bitter type of statesmanship to the highest halls of diplomacy.
I'm sure they're thrilled to hear me speak about it, but that's the way it is. I like to speak my mind and speak the truth.
Well, Donald Trump met Volodymyr Zelensky on the sidelines of the UN summit. The Ukrainian president later welcomed what he called a big shift in Mr. Trump's comments about the war.
He knows some details, and I think he knows more details than usual. Not usual, I mean than before, and I'm happy with this. Trump is a game changer by himself. If he will be sure in Ukraine, and I think that he is more close now to this situation. All of us, we understand, and President Trump, he is ready to give Ukraine security guarantees after this war will finish.
Our State Department correspondent Tom Baterman was at the United Nations in New York as Donald Trump was speaking. He gave us his analysis of the president's remarks, beginning with the comments about the war in Ukraine.
Much of it came actually after his speech in terms of Russia and Ukraine, when he posted on his social media site saying that Ukraine was now in a position to fight back and win all of the territory that Russia had occupied and more. So that is a very significant shift in position. But I have to say that the point remains about this. I mean, he said that the way this would be done was through time and patience and NATO countries helping and supporting and funding Ukraine. But of course, what is happening from the US is that the weapon supply that was appropriated by Congress under the Biden administration is going to start to run dry into next year. There has been no new appropriations from a Republican Congress under President Trump. That is not going to happen. And it's the administration has made very clear that they think it's the job of NATO to buy weapons from the Americans and for the Ukrainians to use those. So once again, I think, you know, we have seen Mr. Trump wax and wane on his sympathies to either side in the war over the last 9 months. And this feels like another one of those. He was meeting Mr. Zelensky. That may be one reason why he was articulating sympathies towards the Ukrainians. But in terms of an actual meaningful strategic shift, I don't sense that from him.
Mr. Trump then seemed to question the United Nations' very existence. And I guess the question is, what is Donald Trump's aim in antagonizing the UN like this, especially doing it in front of them in their lounge, effectively?
Well, you know, I mean, the administration has been really clear in terms of its own ideological agenda. It's already said it seeks to transpose that onto the institutions of multilateralism, which it doesn't like. You know, that is not the Trump administration worldview. It sees a world of competing national powers in which each country looks after its own interests. And you have at the top of the pile the Americans with an America First agenda, using all the tools of power they have to enrich and improve the security and quality of life of Americans. And they say that they expect other countries in the world to do the same for their citizens. And we heard that articulated from Mr. Trump very clearly. They don't like the idea of the United Nations anymore. Their view is that what happened after the Second World War was the creation of these multilateral institutions to salvage the world from the ashes of the Second World War. But they believe that what happened over the following decades was that these institutions effectively got hijacked by a liberal global order that both sort of created a neoliberal economic model of globalization that ended up not serving many in Western countries and was then hijacked by countries like China, who they think exploited the rules. And also, the core theme of Mr. Trump's speech was about migration. He believes that the UN is funding and fueling migration, against the evidence, of course, because migration is caused by structural economic factors, by war and instability and climate change. And so it was a very, very pointed attack on Europe. And as I say, transposing the administration's ideological agenda onto the rest of the world. And they think that institutions like the UN should turn themselves to instituting that worldview rather than, of course, what the institution itself was established for 80 years ago.
Tom Bateman reporting. There's growing alarm across Europe about Russia's actions. NATO has warned Moscow against what it says are an increasing number of airspace violations. In recent weeks, Russia has been accused of sending fighter jets into Estonian airspace and drones over Poland and Romania. There's also been disruption to flights, again because of drones at Copenhagen Airport. NATO's Secretary General Mark Rutte had this warning for Moscow.
decisions on whether to engage intruding aircraft, such as firing upon them, are of course taken in real time, are always based on available intelligence regarding the threat posed by the aircraft, including questions we have to answer like intent and potential risk to Allied forces, civilians or infrastructure.
Russia has denied or downplayed the incursions. Mikey Kay from the BBC News' Security Brief programme, who was himself a helicopter pilot in the British Air Force, told Janet Jalil more about what a country can do if its airspace is violated.
If you've got an unidentified aircraft coming into your airspace, then there have historically, not many, but 9/11's a good example. The threat has to be taken such that it could be a 9/11 scenario. Or if you look at, you know, certain geopolitical situations at the moment where you've got Russian aggression on Ukraine, drones going into Poland, Romania, tensions are heightened. And so this is going to grab the attention very, very quickly of a territorial country. Now, what do they have as capability that can counter that? The main thing is what's called quick reaction alert. Military fast jets stationed on the ground at certain bases in certain countries that are on 24/7 standby. So they are literally in their flying suits, they've got the helmets by them, the jets are prepped, and they can get an alarm to go and intercept an unidentified threat that will get them off the ground in less than 5 minutes.
So what happens when these jets are scrambled? Let's say they're alongside the plane. Talk us through that process.
You want to get that aircraft out of territorial airspace as quick as you can because you don't know what it's doing there. So the next thing that they have to do is they have to get close enough to try and figure out what is the aircraft and what is the aircraft carrying, more importantly. Now, at the same time, they'll be talking to that unidentified threat and start giving them directions to leave territorial airspace as soon as possible. And they'll be quite forceful with that. Because in some occasions, or a lot of occasions, if there were to be an escalation, a rapid escalation, you would need a very high authority of approval in order to engage another aircraft. And we're talking sometimes up to and including cabinet approval and maybe even the Prime Minister.
Or the President. So what would happen if the decision was taken at that high level to shoot down the plane?
The decision at the very, very high level would be based on what are the consequences of that. It has happened in Turkey, for example. A Turkish jet shot down a Russian jet, and that had the potential to create a lot of collateral in terms of diplomacy
It did, actually, for quite a few years, didn't it? Yes.
Exactly that, yeah. Exactly that. And that was a relatively benign environment. So if you're talking a scenario where it's a NATO jet, there's a lot of unintended consequences that can come from that. So the decision is absolutely huge if they were to say, engage that aircraft and take that aircraft out. That could be escalatory geopolitically in a way that could create way more collateral damage.
Mikey Kay, who is speaking to Janet Jalil. Days after a flurry of Western nations announced they would officially recognise a Palestinian state, the future of Gaza has continued to be a big talking point at the UN General Assembly. The Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto told delegates his country was prepared to send at least 20,000 troops to the territory as peacekeepers to safeguard any future peace deal. And there was a passionate speech by the Turkish President Erdogan, who demanded an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
On one side, there is a regular army with the most modern, most lethal weapons. And on the other hand, there are innocent civilians, innocent children. This is not fight against terrorism. This is an occupation, deportation, exile, genocide, and mass destruction policy carried out by invoking the events of October the 7th.
Meanwhile, doctors at Gaza's biggest hospital say they are overwhelmed with casualties, having to carry out surgeries in filthy conditions with few or no anaesthetics. Israeli tanks are now just 500 metres from Al-Shifa Hospital in the centre of Gaza City as the operation against Hamas continues. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison, has been talking to medical staff. Some of the details in this report are distressing.
Gaza City's last barely functioning hospital is in ruins. Pockmarked by craters with burnt out wards and bullet holes, Al-Shifa is beyond full stretch. Inside, many of the beds don't even have mattresses. Medicines are in short supply, and the casualties are endless.
It's just a mass murder, a killing.
We spoke to Dr. Nada Abu Arub, an emergency specialist from Australia, volunteering at the hospital.
We did operations with hardly to minimal to hardly no anesthesia.
So the patients are in agony?
Yes, of course, yes. And there's no painkillers as well. With their limb hanging with a piece of skin and the tendon, brain matter out. Abdomen organs are out. It's horrific.
Last week, the team say they had to conduct a cesarean on a 9-month pregnant woman who had had her head blown off. They managed to save the baby.
Tensions are really high.
Dr. Saya Aziz, an Australian anaesthetist, said every day is a mass casualty event.
Every couple of hours, there's multiple amputation cases where massive resuscitation is life or limb, literally. And, you know, you go in and you're trying to anaesthetise them. They're swatting flies in the theatre.
And outside, Israel's tanks are advancing. They're now just 500 metres from the hospital as the ground offensive against Hamas continues.
Coming up...
For the last 2 years, Al-Shabaab has attempted me 5 times.
In an interview with the BBC, the president of Somalia says he has survived several assassination attempts. In the previous podcast, we reported on the super typhoon that was headed towards southern China. Already the effects of Ragasa have left at least 17 people dead in the Philippines and Taiwan. With wind gusts of 200 kilometers per hour and torrential rain, Ragasa has been called the worst storm of the year. And it's now approaching our correspondent Laura Bicker, who's in Zhuhai on the Chinese coast.
There have been mass evacuations. Around 400,000 people have been evacuated right across this densely populated province. This is a province where most of the things that are made in China come from, huge factories. And in Shenzhen, that's a major technology hub. So that's one of the other concerns. The rainfall is another concern. We're expecting here around a month's worth of rain in just a few days, and it's falling on already saturated ground after previous storms in the last month. Red alerts have been issued in mountain regions for landslips, and people are being urged to stay inside if possible. We're seeing a lot of people heeding that advice. For those who are not, I'm watching right now the police patrolling the streets with their sirens and megaphones telling people to stay inside. We are actually just in the lobby of a hotel, so we're not really outside, we're just in the lobby of the hotel, but still you can feel those gusts of wind and see the huge swathes of rain that are battering this coastline.
Absolutely, it sounds like you're really in the thick of it despite being indoors, as you say. Now the region is used to storms, but does it feel like they're getting worse?
Well, I think that's one of the concerns of China's weather experts. They're monitoring all of this carefully, and they have said in recent years that the typhoons are increasing in intensity. This one they're describing as the king of storms. I think what's also really evident since I've been here in the last 2 days is China's preparedness for these kind of events. They really take it very seriously. Local neighbourhood watches go round telling restaurants to close for the day, making sure that families have somewhere to go. Every building that's above 10 floors, everyone's evacuated, low-lying areas are evacuated. It's all very smooth, very organised. So they are very used to this. And perhaps now that certainly when you hear climate warnings from China's meteorological administration, this is something that they may have to get used to more of in the future.
Laura Bicker reporting. Later on Wednesday in New York, Syria's interim president Ahmed al-Sharaa will address the United Nations General Assembly. He'll be the first Syrian leader to do so since 1967, a milestone for him and for his battle-scarred country. It's the latest unlikely chapter in the journey of a man who fought US troops in Iraq, set up an al-Qaeda offshoot in Syria, and led a lightning rebel advance which toppled Bashar al-Assad last December. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, reports now from Damascus on how Syrians feel about their new leader.
I'm in the old city of Damascus, just under a Roman arch, and I'm surrounded by tourists and visitors and street sellers, plenty of people selling the Syrian flag. And just in front of me are the towering walls of the Umayyad Mosque, which dates from the 8th century. There are huge ornate doors with believers and tourists going in and out. This is a place where you get a strong sense of Syria's past. It's also a place to speak to people about the future and about Syria's new leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa, who is now very much on the world stage in New York.
Welcome. Hello, thank you.
We are from BBC Radio.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Got to be kidding.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Where are you from? Syria.
Welcome, guys. Could we speak to you?
Yeah, sure.
Fantastic. I've just met a young woman here in the old city. Could I ask you your name?
My name is Salam, and I'm 25 years old.
What are your feelings about the new interim leader here, Ahmed al-Sharaa? How do you feel he's doing?
I guess he's trying. You know, like, the country is not at its best now. It's a mess. So it's not easy for him. I guess it's a matter of time. It's a matter of time to see, like, exactly what he's doing and what he's actually up to.
How do you feel about the future here now? As you say, it's early days, but how do you feel about the future?
We are trying to be optimistic because, like, we've been through hell, people. So, like, each little thing, we are trying to catch hope, you know. But we're trying at the same time to be realistic. Like, it's not going to be heaven. It's not going to be paradise here in Syria. But, like, we're trying to be optimistic, like, as much as possible.
I've just met Naya. She's recently graduated from fashion design. Naya, how do you assess the new leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa? How do you think he's doing in the job?
I mean, better than the last one. That's what I'm going to say. We used to feel so like we were held in like a chokehold, you know? We were like you can't do anything. You have to be careful about everything, and you have to, like, you can't even talk normally. You have to be careful of every single word, you know. But now it's, you can technically do whatever you want, which is what I've seen.
Ahmed al-Sharaa is in New York at the moment. He's very much in the headlines. He's all over the TV.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you ever think you'd see a Syrian leader?
No. We're like, oh my God, we're gonna be like represented somehow, you know? Like, it's been so long. Like, my dad doesn't even remember when the last time something like that happened. So, like, I've never in my life lived a year in my life where we were represented like that, you know? Or like we were like acknowledged, you know?
So it's a happy moment.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, yeah.
Will you watch him when he speaks at the General Assembly at the UN?
Of course I will. I think everyone will.
I've just been speaking with a young woman. She's 30 years old. Her name is Kinaz. She was working in a radio station here, but she says there's not much work anymore. She's been telling me about her concerns, not about the president himself, but about the people around him.
I have confidence in him as a person, in his character and language. And when I look at him, I feel comfortable. I really think he has a desire to bring Syria and the Syrians to safety because he's experienced poverty and displacement, just like the Syrians, and he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. But I don't trust the people around him, the factions that aren't under his control. Whenever something happens, they blame it on individuals. And I don't trust the countries around us. May God help him. I don't think he'll be in power long.
Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, reporting. Somalia's President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed has revealed that he is now a target of Al-Shabaab, an Islamist group affiliated to Al-Qaeda. In an interview with the BBC, he said he had survived several assassination attempts by the group. Somalia faces security threats from both Al-Shabaab and ISIS. And despite military interventions by African Union and US forces, the security situation remains dire. President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed has been speaking to the BBC's Paul Njie. He began with this assessment of the security situation in his country.
Somalia has a very serious challenge of security because fighting both Al-Shabaab and ISIS in two different areas. And Al-Shabaab and ISIS are the most notorious terrorists in the world today. Our challenge now is building an army and at the same time fighting on the other hand. So in the last 3 years, we have achieved a significant success and progress. Most of the towns and cities has been liberated from Al-Shabaab, but still they still operate in the rural area. Al-Shabaab is weak, but then compared to their past, but still they are a very serious challenge to the security of the country.
Well, you have lost territory to Al-Shabaab in recent months, and your critics say that your government does not have a clear strategy to defeat them. What do you say to that?
Traditionally, Al-Shabaab was fought with military only. When we come to the office, we have opened many other fronts, ideological war against Al-Shabaab. The major scholars of Somalia told the people that what Al-Shabaab is doing are un-Islamic, besides the military and the ideological, the third front was fighting, financing al-terror. We have closed so many accounts in the banks, in the mobile money.
But the reality still remains that Al-Shabaab continues to gain territory while your strategies are in place.
In a war, you lose battlefields, you gain battlefields. Compared to the 80 locations that has been taken back from Al-Shabaab, in 2 years' time, there is no indication that Al-Shabaab is stronger than it was 2 years ago.
Well, you say that Al-Shabaab is no longer strong, but you were a victim of an assassination attempt and you survived that attempt in March. How was that for you?
I wanted to tell you, for the last 2 years, Al-Shabaab has attempted me 5 times because they believe the switch that they can off the war against them is assassinating the president.
In June, the Trump administration issued a travel ban to several countries, including Somalia, and they described your nation as a, quote, terrorist safe haven. Is this a fair portrayal of your country?
I completely disagree. A safe haven of a terrorist is where the terrorist is not challenged.
Did you express your disapproval to President Trump?
I disapprove the term that Somalia is a terrorist safe haven. I disagree and I disapprove that.
Somalia is now a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council. It's the first time since 1972. What does that mean for you and how are you leveraging on this?
That's a proof that Somalia is progressing. We have been lifted the arms embargo on Somalia after 32 years. We have been given the debt relief of almost $5 billion. And we have accepted in many organizations, the East Africa community, like the United Nations Security Council. That itself is a proof that Somalia is defeating Al-Shabaab.
President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed speaking to Paul Ngie. Along with spaghetti, you're Italy's greatest invention. The actress Claudia Cardinale said this was the best compliment she ever received. It was said by the actor David Niven during the filming of the movie The Pink Panther. The Tunisian-born star of Italian cinema has died at the age of 87 near Paris. Mark Duff looks back at the life and career of a woman who the Los Angeles Times magazine named one of the most beautiful women in film history.
By the time film lovers caught sight of Claudia Cardinale emerging into the bleak desert landscape of Once Upon a Time in the West, there was no doubting her star quality. Her character, Jill McBain, a strong single woman, undaunted by the tough predatory men who surround her, went some way towards challenging Hollywood's brutal sexual stereotypes. For all that, though, she was undeniably beautiful, Italy's answer to her French friend, Brigitte Bardot. And early on, it was her beauty which got top billing.
Occasionally a role and a picture are so impressive that we behind the camera want to shout about it from the rooftops.
Burt Lancaster announcing his latest film in 1963.
The film is The Leopard. The beautiful Claudia Cardinale and Alain Delon are also starred under the masterful direction of Luchino Visconti.
When the big studios came calling, she dealt with them on her own terms, as she explained in a BBC interview.
They asked me to sign the contract, but I always refused. I want to be dependent and free. I did lots of movies, but I want to live in Europe.
I just wonder whether you felt there was a danger, you know, being a beautiful woman actor, of being typecast, pigeonholed, packaged for your sexuality and nothing else.
Yeah, I always refuse to do scenes naked. Always. They ask me, many. I said no. I don't want to sell my body. And I want to be judged on the acting.
Instead of Hollywood, she chose and was chosen to work with some of the giants of European cinema. The German, Werner Herzog, and two of the greatest of all Italian directors, Visconti, and his stylistic opposite, Federico Fellini.
Oh, it was fantastic, Federico. And the funny thing is, with Visconti, it was impossible to speak and to smile. Nothing. Silence. With Federico, everybody had the telephone and speaking and laughing. Because if it was silent, he couldn't create. That was Federico. He was a magician.
It could all have been so different. She was born to Sicilian immigrants in Tunis, was talent spotted at a beauty contest she'd won without even entering, and shrugged off the early attention of filmmakers.
When they asked me to do cinema, I refused for a long, long time. And the more I said no, the more they insist. It's like when a boy, you know, it's coming. And you say yes immediately, it goes away.
Behind the throaty chuckle, there was sadness too. She was raped young, kept the baby, but was encouraged to keep his birth secret for years by pretending he was her young brother. All this for fear it would damage her fledgling career. Perhaps that experience lay behind her work in later life on women's rights for the UN. She empathised too with the suffering of migrants making the dangerous voyage across the Mediterranean from her place of birth in search of a better life. And her work rate, her energy, was phenomenal. As she put it herself, if you give up, it's the end. You have to fight all the time.
Mark Duff, looking back at the life of Claudia Cardinale, who's passed away at the age of 87. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this episode or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at BBC World Service, and you can use the hashtag Global News Pod. The edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was Ed Horton. The editor is Karen Martin, and I'm Ankur Desai. Until next time, goodbye.